Thank you, Caitlin. That was very generous. I'm certainly flattered to be here. It's customary to say something such as, I'm so delighted to be here. I'm actually a little bit intimidated by this task. I'm not entirely sure that I'm up to it. This is, in a way, the inaugural event of the graduation season. And so I feel a weight on my shoulders. I've been asked by the SBA to deliver what it calls a charge to the class. What this means is not entirely clear, I'm sure, to you, but it's not entirely clear to me either. We all have some idea what a charge is. We know, for example, at least I'm sure because I recognize your faces, many of you know what a charge to a jury is. In general, a charge is a set of instructions based on pre-existing standards or pre-existing rules that are supposed to guide the recipient's actions or deliberations. So it seems I am to give you a set of instructions or commend to you some insights that might help to guide you in the future. The charge to a class is a relatively young tradition here. The inaugural charge was delivered by Professor Lillian Bevere a few years ago. Her charge contained considerable wisdom. So did the charges of my colleagues who followed her. Unfortunately, if the Department of the Treasury were doing a stress test to evaluate my assets the way it's doing a stress test on banks, I'm afraid that it would find that I have a wisdom shortfall. And I face a second problem. So much more is thrown at a person over a lifetime by chance than by design. Advice that would be right for one person might well be wrong for another person. I'm reluctant to suggest what you should do or even what you should think about as your lives and your plans are interrupted by events that are beyond your control. Finally, as those of you who've been my students know, I believe that in the wrong hands, rules can be dangerous things. Rules are wonderful instruments in the hands of courts. But in their simplicity, rules can mislead the uninitiated, especially those who are new to the law. Rules can mask the complexity of the cases whose results they summarize. And in their generality, rules sometimes lack the subtlety that the law in practice actually exhibits. Yet it seems to be expected that I deliver a charge or set of instructions that will look and sound very much like rules about some aspect of life or of law that you might follow. My solution to this problem, as it so often has been, is not to give you the rules. Instead, I propose to give you the cases themselves and encourage you to understand on your own what rules these cases might be thought to stand for. In this instance, the cases are not judicial decisions. I'm sure you're delighted to hear that. They aren't even disputes. But like legal decisions, the cases I will give you are exemplars. I won't go so far as to call them stories, or as legal scholars have taken to calling them, narratives. I will simply say that they are four accounts. I've tried to choose a neutral term. Three about individuals and one about a group of people from which you may wish to derive your own insights and perhaps even lessons. I want to say I do not offer these accounts as objects of critical analysis. We spend a great deal of time in law school probing for weaknesses in arguments and judicial opinions and in theories. We construct our own arguments and our own theories. but we learn that these are always imperfect, always vulnerable to counter-argument. Indeed, sometimes we construct our own arguments and our own theories precisely in order to see how they may be vulnerable. The accounts I will give you in a moment are not like that. At least I do not intend them to be like that. There is no, on the other hand, spoken or unspoken, in my accounts. Only two of them involve lawyers, but even these do not involve law. So this is not a typical analysis, as you will see. Perhaps the best thing is not for me to describe any further what I'm doing, but just to get on and do it. First, I want to tell you about Virginia Apgar. Until 60 years ago, childbirth was the single most dangerous event in a woman's life. One in 150 pregnancies ended in the death of the mother. By the 1950s, in part because of higher medical standards, but also because of penicillin and other antibiotics, the risk of death for a mother in childbirth had declined more than 90% to just one in 2,000. But the situation wasn't so encouraging for babies. In 1940, one newborn in 30 still died in childbirth. Then came a doctor named Virginia Apgar. Those of you who do not have children probably have not heard of her. But all modern parents know about what she did for our children, including, I'm sure, what she did for virtually every one of you. Before you had grades in high school, before you had SAT scores, before you had an LSAT score, you had an Apgar score. Virginia Apgar was one of the first women in the country to be admitted to a surgical residency, in this case at Columbia University in 1933. At the end of her residency, her chairman told her that, however good she was, a female surgeon had little chance of attracting patients. He persuaded her to join Columbia's faculty as an anesthesiologist, at that time a position of lesser status. She became the second woman in the country to be board certified in anesthesiology. She established anesthesia as its own department at Columbia, on equal footing with surgery. Virginia Apgar administered anesthesia to over 20,000 patients during her career. She carried a scalpel and a length of rubber tubing in her purse in case a passerby needed an emergency tracheotomy. You may laugh, but it is said that she saved 12 people on the streets of New York in her career in this way. For young doctors facing an emergency, she had some simple advice. Decide what is right and do it now. That's what she used to say. Decide what is right and do it now. Throughout her career, the work Virginia Apgar loved most was providing anesthesia for child deliveries. She was appalled by the poor care that many newborns received. Babies who were malformed or too small or just blue and could not breathe well were listed as stillborn, placed out of sight, and left to die. They were believed to be too sick to live. Apgar believed otherwise, but she had no authority to challenge these conventions. She was a female doctor in a male world. She took a less direct, but ultimately more powerful approach. She devised a measure of infant well-being. The Apgar score, as it became universally known, allowed nurses to rate the condition of newborn babies on a scale of 0 to 10. An infant got 2 points if it was pink all over, 2 for crying, 2 for taking good, vigorous breaths, something I'd like to do right now, 2 for moving all four limbs, and 2 if its heart rate was over 100. 10 points meant a child in perfect condition. 4 points or less meant a blue, limp baby. The Apgar score was first published in 1953, and it transformed child delivery. It turned an intangible and impressionistic clinical concept, the condition of a newborn baby, into a number that people could collect and compare. Using it required documentation of the true condition of every baby. Moreover, even if only because doctors are competitive, it drove them to want to produce better scores and therefore better outcomes for the newborns they delivered. Around the world now, virtually every child who's delivered in a hospital has an Apgar score, recorded at 1 minute after birth and at 5 minutes after birth. It quickly became clear that a baby with a terrible Apgar score at 1 minute could nonetheless often be resuscitated with measures like oxygen and warming to an excellent score at 5 minutes. Spinal and then epidural anesthesia for the mother were found to produce babies with better scores than general anesthesia. Other innovations, such as neonatal intensive care units, followed. The Apgar score changed everything. It was practical. It was easy to administer. It was easy to calculate, and it gave clinicians at the bedside immediate information on how they were doing. All this from a woman who became an anesthesiologist because she suffered from discrimination, but who lived by her motto, decide what is right and do it now. None of us can do any better than that. My next account involves a tragic, inexplicable shooting, the kind of thing that happened at Columbine 10 years ago yesterday, at Blacksburg 2 years ago, and in Binghamton just last month. On October 2, 2006, during your first semester in law school, a deranged milkman named Charles Roberts walked into an Amish schoolhouse near Georgetown, Pennsylvania. He told the boys in the class to leave. Then he lined the girls up against the wall and began shooting them. Five died. Then he killed himself. Roberts had lived among the Amish with his wife Marie and their three little children, ages 2 through 7, in the same community as the families whose children were in the school that day. The funerals of the murdered girls were held in that area, according to Amish custom, in horse-drawn black hearses. No parent, no community can ever recover from something like that. The wounds do not heal. But then it emerged that the Amish, despite their wounds and despite their grief, truly lived according to their beliefs. They let it be known that Marie Roberts and her children would not have to move. The Amish people said that the Roberts family would be welcome to continue living in their neighborhood and that they would be treated with compassion. They would not be blamed for what had happened. They would be free to live their lives without enmity or interference from the Amish. Now, I am not a Christian, and practices followed by some Amish, such as shunning, I do not admire. But this was as Christian a gesture as I have ever seen. The Amish showed that they would live their Christianity, that they would follow the lesson of the Sermon on the Mount despite their grief and their anger. These gentle people of principle showed the world what it means to be righteous. Next, I want to tell you about Mortimer Kaplan. Some people here who've been in my torts class have heard this before, but it'll be good to hear it again. You know the name Kaplan from the rooms in the law school that bear it. This one, as well as Kaplan Auditorium and Kaplan Reading Room. What most of you do not know is the life of the person after whom these rooms are named. Mortimer Kaplan came to the university in 1933. At the age of 17. He enrolled in the college and joined the boxing team, the university's leading sport back then. He was undefeated in the ring for 3 years. In his senior year, he won the NCAA middleweight championship while fighting with a broken hand. He then came to the law school, where he also excelled. He was editor-in-chief of the Law Review. After he graduated in 1940, he entered the Navy. I was aware that he had served in World War II, but I knew him for 15 years before he told me that he had been a beachmaster on Omaha Beach on D-Day, June 6, 1944. The job of everyone else on D-Day was to get off the beach, where they were most vulnerable to enemy fire, and move inland as soon as possible. Everyone, that is, except the beachmasters. The beachmaster's job was to stay on the beach while under fire, and direct traffic. Morty Kaplan survived that day, and others like it. He came back to the law school, and he taught here. He was a tax law professor from 1950 to 1961, where one of his students was one Robert F. Kennedy. In 1961, in part, of course, because of this connection, Kaplan was named by President Kennedy to be Commissioner of the Internal Revenue Service. When he retired from that position, along with his former student, Douglas Drysdale, of the law school class of 1954, he founded the firm of Kaplan and Drysdale. It is now the preeminent tax law firm in the United States. The University of Virginia does not give honorary degrees. Its two highest awards are the Jefferson Medals in Law and in Architecture, awarded each spring on Founders Day, April 13th. Mortimer Kaplan won the Jefferson Award in Law in 2001. That award was only a tangible recognition of the less tangible love for and commitment to this place that he has displayed for many decades. For almost 76 years, Mortimer Kaplan has been associated with the University of Virginia. He has given millions of dollars to the law school, like thousands of our alumni. I mean this literally. He goes to sleep at night thinking about the law school, and he wakes up in the morning thinking about the law school. No law school could have a more loyal alumnus than Mortimer Kaplan. At the age of 93, he is the law school's favorite son. Finally, I want to speak about Thomas Jefferson. It is not fashionable to praise Jefferson these days. The almost automatic reverence that he once commanded has diminished, and properly so. He not only owned slaves, but he fathered the children of at least one of them. And though he understood that slavery was an abomination, he was complicit with the other founding fathers in passing on this evil to another generation. But if we only condemn Jefferson, we will miss what he has to teach us. Here is just a bit of that. Until the 20th century, the University of Virginia had no president. The university was governed by a board. The leader of the board of most colleges and universities has the title of chairman or chair. Here, from the time of the university's founding, the leader of the board has had the title of rector. This title, I think, reflects one of the principles on which Jefferson founded the university, that the pursuit of knowledge is a virtuous undertaking, and that rectitude, moral uprightness, is a necessary ingredient of that undertaking. As is commonly the case in university administration, the first two rectors of the university came to their positions with prior experience. By the time of his appointment, the second rector, James Madison, had, among other things, been Secretary of State, President, author of the most important essays in the Federalist Papers, and principal architect of the Constitution of the United States. The first rector was Thomas Jefferson, who also had a good resume. Jefferson was the only person in Western history to make world-class contributions in both government and the arts. To combine the prose of power and the poetry of art, as Gary Wills has put it, at a high and continuing level is something that no one else has ever done. We know about Jefferson's contributions to government, but Jefferson is also this country's most influential architect. He established an ethos and a rationale for our public buildings. It is his authority that binds us, for good or for ill, to a sense that ancient Roman forms express civic responsibility and gravitas. Yet his greatest achievements in architecture still stand here in this small town. While Jefferson lived, Monticello was, and even today it still is, the foremost home in the nation. This is all the more remarkable because back then Monticello truly was in the middle of nowhere. Charlottesville had a population of 300 people in 1780. The nearest place of any size was 70 miles away. John Dos Passos rightly called Monticello a portico on the wilderness. There was nothing west of here, really. Yet the finest home on the entire continent stood on a little hill outside of town. As fine as Monticello may be, Jefferson's even greater achievement was the cluster of buildings at this university, which he founded and which he called his academical village. Here he launched what was, aside from the construction of Washington, D.C. itself, the largest public works project undertaken between the Revolution and the Civil War. In 1976, on the 200th anniversary of American independence, the American Institute of Architects polled professional critics and practitioners for what it called the proudest achievements in American architecture. The University of Virginia finished first. The World Heritage Convention of the United Nations identifies world treasures that have what it calls outstanding universal value. Included on this list are the pyramids of Egypt and the Great Wall of China. The World Heritage List contains only 18 world treasures in the United States. The Grand Canyon is on that list of 18, along with the University of Virginia and Monticello. Only one other public building is listed along with the university. And that building is Independence Hall in Philadelphia, which Jefferson did not design, but which, in a sense, his eloquence made famous. Jefferson worked from a profound belief in the moral, political, and even pedagogical importance of art and architecture. He believed that one's physical surroundings affect the quality of one's learning. He was, moreover, a man whose creativity deepened and became bolder with age. Gives me some comfort. He went from strength to strength almost to the moment of his death. From 1817 to 1826, as he passed from his 74th to his 83rd year, in his final creative act, he poured his spirit into the physical expression of intellectual activity that is the place we now call the Lawn, the original university that stands just a mile from where we sit. If Jefferson had only been a private citizen all his life, what he did here in this little town would be sufficient to mark his enduring genius. So this concludes my four accounts, my exemplars, my cases. At this point, I might be expected to draw a lesson from them for you. But that would mean giving you a rule that they stand for. And we know that you must come to understand what rule, if any, to derive from these examples through your own deliberation, not by my telling you what the rule is. I will say this. All four accounts are accounts of civic virtue, of different forms of excellence. It would be nice if we could emulate them, but more importantly, we can admire them. We can be inspired by them. And we can govern ourselves so that when we encounter excellence in others, we value and we support it. Our own lives will be richer and more meaningful if we appreciate and if we savor the excellence around us. So now, although I cannot give you a rule, I can point you in the right direction. I can help you to make a beginning. Here's my instruction, my charge to you today. You can carry it out any day before you graduate. It is not long, so listen, or you will miss it. Early in the morning, before dawn, go to the lawn. Wait for the sun to rise while you stand on the steps of the rotunda. What you see, as the morning light brings the Jeffersonian buildings into view, will take your breath away. You will know then, if you did not know already, why excellence matters. Thank you.